would have been so.
In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
Live. This is the Lars Larson Show.
President Trump is one badass president. He's secured over at a level we've never seen before.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
For our country and for our children, the best is yet to come.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network.
Lars.
And now.
He is an existential threat to democracy.
Here's your host.
Quiet, please.
Lars Larson.
Hey, welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a Wednesday, and I want you to consider this question because I think there are a lot of different aspects to it, and I think we're going to see examples of this all over the place. But think about this. When a small town and the people in it vote not to pay for certain public services, should the taxpayers from the rest of the state or the rest of the region bail that town out? I'm going to tell you my answer to that is no. Because I think the people in that town have a right to decide which services do we want. And if we've decided we don't want certain services, we don't want a library, we don't want parks, we don't want a sheriff's department, we don't want jails. I understand it seems colossally stupid. And sometimes you could say, well, every town needs that stuff. Yes. Do you know what else every town needs? They need the ability of the people who live in that town to decide what level of taxation do we want, which services do we want, and which services do we not want. And if a town votes against services, and there is one in particular I'm going to give to you in just a moment, then they should be able to do that. And the rest of the state, the rest of the region should feel no obligation to bail that town out, not one little bit. But let me get into the details of that in a moment. First, welcome to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you on a Wednesday and live on the Radio Northwest Network, where we endeavor to serve the Pacific Northwest states of Oregon, Washington, and Idaho with honestly provocative talk on a daily basis. And if you want to join the conversation, you're always welcome at 866-HEY-LARS. And if you're a naysayer, naysayers for 30 years we have always put to the head of the line at 866-439-5277. Send emails to talk at LarsLarson.com. And our X poll question, should Capitol Hill bail out a failing Hollywood entertainment industry with your tax dollars? Now, why is anybody even considering that? In some ways, it goes with my lead-off topic, which is, do Americans have a right to make a choice about what they support and what they don't support? Consider this. Hollywood has thumbed its nose at middle-class America for decade after decade after decade. And now Hollywood wants plumbers and construction workers and taxi drivers and average Americans to bail them out. It seems that Hollywood is in big trouble. Because President Trump has embraced the idea of a federal tax credit of 15 to 25% to encourage the production of domestic film and television projects. Now, do I want to see movies shot in America? I do. Do I want to see taxpayers on the hook to provide tax incentives, and in this case, tax credits to make that happen? I do not want that. They say employment and production in Hollywood is down by almost half. The number of on-location shoot days in Los Angeles has dropped from 37,000 just 4 years ago to under 20,000 as of last year. That's a drop of 46%. Production has shifted to locations where labor is cheaper and union rules less stringent. Fine. Then let Hollywood suck it up. They can either stick with the crazy rules and the crazy taxes, or they can provide their own tax incentive by making Hollywood, again, a place where it's a good idea to shoot movies and TV shows there. Donald Trump claims the tax credits will pay for themselves as the Committee to Unleash Prosperity, which is Steve Moore, the economist, who's a former Donald Trump advisor. He says, we doubt that's going to be the case. So should Capitol Hill bail out Hollywood? No, absolutely not. In any case, you can find the X poll at Lars Larson Show and at LarsLarson.com. But let me get back to this question of what towns have a right to do and a responsibility to do. If the voters of a town, in this case, Independence, Oregon, small town, nice little town, but you know what they did? The voters in that town said, we are not interested in passing a levy. So about a week ago, the town of Independence closed five of its parks. They said, we don't have the money to keep them open. But they did get a grant from a nonprofit organization called Friends of Community Parks that gave them 30 grand so they can reopen a couple of their parks. but they say this current tax system is failing Oregon cities and counties. No, it's not failing them at all, at least not in my view. In my view, local government can go to its citizens and say, you can have a library, you can have parks, you can have all these other services or not. It's your choice. They say before 1990, local governments had more flexibility to raise property taxes. And so the folks who want to raise taxes say, well, that's a failure of the system because voters went to the ballot and they passed three different ballot measures between 1990 and 1997. And they put limits on the kind of taxes that local government could collect. There's nothing wrong with that. In fact, think of it this way. If you walk into a restaurant, I like food, so let's use food as an example. You walk into a restaurant. Should they assume that you want everything on the menu and that you're willing to pay for it? They should not. They should ask you, what would you like? Would you like a drink? No, I'd like a glass of water. Would you like an appetizer? No, not at all. Maybe the main course, but that's it. Would you like dessert? No, I don't need that either. You are free to say yes or no to any of that. It's on the menu, but you can choose what you want. What have the voters done? They have chosen to say, we want to put a limit on how much taxes can be raised by small communities. So, in the case of Independence, Oregon, they are now proposing, this is Paul Evans from Monmouth, which is not too far away from Independence, Oregon. He wants to have a plan in the next legislative session, in the first part of next year, to propose a $1 million fund housed at the state's economic development agency called Business Oregon, which has its own corruption problems, which would allow cities with less than 20,000 residents to apply for a grant or a low-interest loan to maintain their parks, their libraries, and their museums and other what they call essential community spaces when they face a budget crisis. I think that's ridiculous, and I'll tell you why. I mean, you say, but Lars, you're helping out small towns. No. Those small towns and the people who live in them have the absolute right. They have the sovereignty to decide, do we want to run our libraries? Do we want to run our museums? Do we want to maintain our parks? And I can tell you that in this day and age, there are plenty of reasons why citizens might reasonably say, we don't want to provide the funding. They see some of the garbage that is served up by the libraries, like drag queen story hour. They see some of the garbage that's served up in the parks. They see museums that are catering to the politically correct and the woke instead of catering to the people who are actually funding their operation. If those citizens say, we don't want to fund that stuff, they have the right to do that. And if you say, oh, but when you decide not to buy those things, we're going to go ahead and take money from other people in the state or the region, and we're going to fund it for you. I don't think that makes any sense. In fact, I think it takes away the right of citizens to decide what are the city services that we want and what are the city services that we don't. The Independent City Council in June voted to impose fees of $19 a month to pay for operations of the city's libraries, parks, and a local museum. And why? Because they can collect it through the utility bills. But what happens when local voters said, no, we're going to put that thing to a vote, and they put it on the ballot for November? They have a right to vote it up or down, and if they vote it down, those services should stop. And the community can live with it, or they can vote to fund them. Either way, it's their choice, not ours. You've got the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network. And high credit card in.
If you don't want to talk but want to be heard, email Lars at talk@larslarson.com. He actually will read it. Now, here's Lars Larson.
That makes a lot of sense. A lot of nonsense.
Right. You're bloody well right. You know you got a right to say.
This is the Northwest Nonsense.
How much longer do we have to sit for this nonsense?
Pumped by River City Environmental. That great moment every day where Lars brings you the cold, hard facts without any liberal wokeness from the Daily Dead fish wrapper or mainstream media bias.
Well, for a public school system facing multi-million dollar shortfalls and dropping enrollment, the Portland Public Schools sent out some strange messages last night, considering a pay raise for Dr. Kimberly Armstrong, who already makes almost a third of $1 million $1 million a year as the captain of this educational Titanic. The superintendent, who came on board about 2 years ago, has enjoyed $20,000 in pay hikes since then. The district is bleeding students by the thousands as parents flee from failing government-run schools. But Dr. Armstrong will enjoy more pay hikes. Oh, and by the way, her monthly car allowance, even in an anti-car city like Portland, has nearly doubled from $400 to $750 a month. The district has cut hundreds of teaching positions from the schools, with students where half the kids make the grade and the other half fail. Not much of a success story. So, taxpayers get this message. The schools are failing students, they're failing parents, and they're failing taxpayers. But they perform on steroids for anybody who draws a paycheck there. I only wonder how long taxpayers will tolerate being told to shut up and ignore the educational disaster. Just shut up and pay your taxes. Glad to get your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. If you're a naysayer, naysayers always go right to the head of the line at 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk at LarsLarson.com. Vote in our poll on X. You'll find the question at Lars Larson Show on X. You'll also find it on my website at LarsLarson.com. Our question of the day, brought to you by Multnomah Medical Clinic. No pills, no shots, no surgery. Fix what's actually causing the problem at Multnomah Medical Clinic. Consider this. The Seattle Education Association appears to have lost the PR battle. Now, the SEA is the labor union that represents teachers in Seattle. SEA members have decided that they're going to keep on negotiating. In other words, they got right up to the edge of a strike. They were threatening parents that maybe school would happen today in Seattle. Maybe it wouldn't, depending on what they did. Did they get a new contract? No. They're going to keep on negotiating. And at some point, they may decide to go on strike again. The negotiations had stalled. They have all kinds of proposals. The district is offering almost 9% in raises over the next 3 years, and they get paid some of the highest teacher salaries in America, with a work year that's about 180 days long. And the superintendent, Ben Schuldinger, he should be praised for calling out the union and negotiating, the union for negotiating in bad faith. The president of their union, who is a special ed teacher, is currently suspended from teaching because she was found to have likely assaulted some of the kids. So, shame on the SEA and its membership for putting parents on the hook. And now today's Daily Grill.
Insane.
Are you completely insane?
Ridiculous.
They get more and more ridiculous.
Flat out dumb.
You're even dumber than I thought.
Who deserves today's Lars Grill of the Day?
Maybe they're just really, really stupid.
Presented by Oregon City Garage Door.
Well, I don't get requests for grills very often, but I did get this one. Lars, I wish you would give one of your grills of the day to the Oregon Lottery Commission and its director for allowing staff to spend more than $3,000 to rent a suite for a Trailblazer game. It was for a, quote, meeting with Blazer officials to talk about a partnership endeavor, and violated the lottery's own meeting policy, which prohibits this kind of meeting expense. The commission also approved doubling the advertising budget in fiscal year 27 from $4.8 million to $9.6 million. The result, or the reason, is a $5 million partnership with the Portland Trailblazers. The lottery has never done a partnership with a sports team before. Furthermore, the Oregon Revised Statutes, that's the laws of the state of Oregon, specifically say the lottery can only pay for its own expenses to operate the lottery. It's questionable whether that we stand to get enough benefit for that $5 million to justify the expense, especially when the lottery has never needed that much advertising before, and it certainly seems to do very well. It's just another end run for Governor Kotek to fund more dollars that should go to economic development for dispersal to the governor's pet projects without public scrutiny. Now, I would love to talk to the lottery folks about this. Did they have a meeting like that? Did they spend over $3,000 to rent a suite for a Trailblazer game? Did they have a meeting with Trailblazer officials? Did Governor Kotek say, I can get you $5 million out of the lottery, even though the money ought to go to economic development? If any of that happened, the public should really know. Anyway, glad to get your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. My favorite post on social media so far, Rip Wheeler writes, who is really wasting taxpayer money? Washington Secretary of State Steve Hobbs says that a federal investigation into the state of Washington and other states over alleged voter fraud is troubling and a waste of taxpayer dollars. And Rip Wheeler, or R.I.P. Wheeler, says, let's talk about taxpayer dollars. During Governor Bob Ferguson's time as attorney general, his office filed 97 lawsuits against the Trump administration. By January of 21, 97 lawsuits filed, 39 legal victories, 56 cases awaiting judicial rulings, and now Nick Brehm is continuing the same strategy against Trump in his second administration. Washington has filed dozens more lawsuits against the Trump administration. Now Nick Brown's office is doing the same thing. 37 lawsuits by September of 2025. Every one of those lawsuits involves attorneys, staff time, experts, discovery, court filings, travel, appeals, and years of litigation. So when Washington politicians complain that the Department of Homeland Security investigating election integrity is a waste of taxpayer dollars, here's the obvious question. Where was that concern when the state of Washington was spending taxpayer resources fighting the federal government in court? If Washington believes that elections are secure, then cooperate with the legitimate investigations and prove it. This is the same question I've been asking you all along. I've said, if you really think you've got the most secure election system ever heard of, and that's what Democrats will tell you, then why would you object to somebody coming in and doing an audit of that? And determining whether or not it really is a secure system. Glad to get your calls on Wednesday. 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. Coming up in a moment, a sheriff in the Northwest accused of taking property from a dead man, misusing public assets, and lying about ammunition. How is John Ward still the sheriff in Curry County, Oregon? We'll get to that in just a moment. You got the Lars Larson.
The Lars Larson Show.
Portland's news, traffic, and weather station.
Interviews, podcasts, local and national news. Get it all at LarsLarson.com. Now, back to the Lars Larson Show.
Hey, welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. I'm glad to get to your phone calls and emails at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. Our poll on X today. We put up a brand new poll question every day, and this one has to do with someone where I'm going to have to disagree with President Donald Trump. Donald Trump has gotten behind a proposal to allow federal tax credits that would support domestic film and television projects. It's a way of bailing out Hollywood, California. Well, I think Hollywood is dying under the weight of its own ridiculous policies in Southern California. They have high taxes, they have high regulations, they have unions, they have all of that stuff. And what's happened? In just the last few years, the number of what they call shoot days in Los Angeles, this is for either film or television projects, has dropped from 37,000 shoot days in a single year to under 20,000, and the drop is continuing. So that means that production of television and movies in Los Angeles is dropping. And why? They're going elsewhere. You might have noticed that Breaking Bad a number of years ago went all the way down to Albuquerque, New Mexico. And why? Because it was a better place to shoot. The costs were lower. The scenery was still there. And frankly, the Pacific Northwest has had the advantage of standing in. Oregon in particular has stood in for all 50 of America's states. 58 if you're an Obama voter. But 50 states, and Oregon can do all of them. It has the mountains, it has the rivers, it has the coastline, it has all of that. It can do a stand-in for any of them. So the fact that television and film are fleeing from Hollywood, California, Hollywood can make a choice to change the rules. And they can say, we're going to have lower tax rates, we're going to have less in the way of regulations, we're not going to kowtow to the unions all day long. They could do that. If they choose not to do that, I don't see any reason, and I know it pains me to disagree with Donald Trump on this, but Donald Trump has embraced a proposal for a federal tax credit of 15 to 25%. Now, remember what a federal tax credit is. A deduction is when you spend money on a project and you get to take that amount of money off the income that you earn back from the project. That's a tax deduction. A tax credit is where somebody can actually get money from the federal government. Even if they haven't made any money on the project, it's money that goes right into your pocket. And Trump is backing an idea for a federal tax credit of between 15 and 25% to boost the production of films and TV projects. And this is in particular to bail out Hollywood. As far as I'm concerned, I think Hollywood should just, if it's going to die under its own weight, so be it. In any case, glad to get your calls. If you want to join the best conversation in talk journalism, it's 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. And, of course, naysayers always go to the head of the line. Let me tell you about Marie Perez. Now, you might say, Lars, you have a dog in the fight because, in theory, Congresswoman Marie Perez represents me. I happen to live in the 3rd Congressional District of Washington State. Well, 3 years ago, Marie Perez announced that she was, quote, going to war with the VA, with the Veterans Administration. Then she voted against full funding for the Veterans Administration. And now she's having one heck of a time trying to explain to her constituents who show up at town hall meetings why she hasn't fully funded the VA. When asked why she voted against funding VA hospitals, Marie Perez became so agitated, she was angry that the constituent was even asking the question. And she implied that it wasn't worth her time to draft legislation to fund veterans' health, and that doing so would simply be virtue signaling. 2023, Marie Perez voted against legislation that provided nearly $300 billion for the Veterans Administration and would have fully funded veterans' health care benefits and other critical projects, and then faced voters and tried to explain away her indefensible record. She dodged the responsibility and said, oh, we're going to war against the VA. Well, it sounds like your constituents are going to hold you to that, and Marie Perez needs to be replaced by John Braun. Let's go to Ron in Tacoma. Hey, Ron, welcome to Wednesday on the Radio Northwest Network. What's on your mind today?
Well, I'm with you, Lars, on the whole, I don't like giving money away for projects like this, but if there was a caveat on this, like, gee, we would fund that percentage of movies that were pro-American movie message, I might be more inclined to accept something like that.
You know why I'm not? I want to point something out to you, Ron. When Hollywood does pro-American movies, and they do so occasionally, and when they do, they have gigantic success. And you know what they then usually do? Is they completely ignore the success, and they go back to making the same crap they've always made. And let me give you a couple of good examples, especially when America was in the Persian Gulf and we had wars going in places like Iraq. Hollywood churned out about 8 or 10 movies that were anti-American, anti-war movies. And they had 8 or 10 failures. And then they came out with a movie called The Hurt Locker that did amazingly well. It was very pro-military. It was very pro-America. And it did very well. And Hollywood then just ignored the success. They did the same thing with Saving Private Ryan. You could go right down the list, and I'm sure somebody's got a more comprehensive list than the one I have, you know, just off the cuff. But Hollywood knows what sells to Americans. And you know what I think most of Hollywood says? We don't like the tastes of Americans. We don't want to make the kind of movies that Americans want to go to. Well, that's their choice, and they get the failure that goes with it. Top Gun Maverick is another great example. Top Gun Maverick. Now, is that a pro-America, stand-up-and-cheer, rah-rah, very pro-American movie? Did very, very well at the box office. Did Hollywood then say, hey, if that's what's selling to American movie-going audiences, let's make some more of that? Ron, do you see any evidence they did that?
Oh, no. I have to tend to agree with you on this subject. Sorry, America.
Well, and in that case, would it be better to prop up Hollywood with tax credits or to say to Hollywood, if that's the direction you choose to go, you've got a state in which they've laid on taxes that are deeper and thicker than almost every other place in America. You've got a regulatory environment that's very, very expensive to shoot movies in. You've got a union environment. And, of course, the laws that are on the books in California very much support the idea that if you don't use labor unions, you're not going to be able to shoot movies. So you've got the taxes, the regulations, and the labor unions, and then the choice of material. What kind of movies are you going to produce? Anti-American movies, great. You know what? I hope you go broke. Shouldn't we all hope they go broke if that's the choice of what they choose to make?
Oh, absolutely. And I think Hollywood has just basically, I don't know what happened after 2000, but it seemed like after 2000, Hollywood just turned into a propaganda outfit for the day.
Unfortunately, you're right. Ron, thanks for the call. Thanks for listening on KBI, part of our Radio Northwest Network. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show. Find yourself looking around.
If you're surrounded by Northwest liberals,
I cannot stand these morons any longer. If you don't come with me this instant, I shall run amok.
Come to the place where common sense prevails, the Lars Larson Show.
Hey, welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. I'm glad to get to your phone calls and emails on this Wednesday. We're live on the Radio Northwest Network, where we attempt to serve the Pacific Northwest states of Oregon, Washington, and Idaho with honestly provocative talk. And if you believe in supporting American craftsmanship and veterans and independent talk radio, go to my website and pick up a limited edition Lars Larson Show challenge coin, proudly made by American veterans. Each one comes with a personally signed thank you card, and all proceeds from the sale of those challenge coins goes to benefit American veterans. Not a dime of it comes to our radio show. The X poll question today: should Capitol Hill bail out a failing Hollywood entertainment industry using your tax dollars? I would say no to that question. You can answer the question any way you like. You'll find the X poll every day at Lars Larson Show and at LarsLarson.com. Yesterday's poll question: should welfare recipients be allowed to spend taxpayer-funded benefits on whatever they want? Florida is now the first state in America that's actually going to put working limits on what you can spend TANF dollars on. TANF is temporary aid to needy families, and that money is paid out in cash benefits. So unlike food stamps, you can actually spend it on things that require cash money. Well, 96% of you said no, welfare recipients should not be able to do that. I had a couple of emails, including one from a gentleman who said, well, there are laws on the books in the state of Washington that limit the kinds of things that you can spend TANF benefits on. But I asked, well, how often are you going to find that the TANF benefits are being regulated, that if somebody breaks that rule and spends the money on things that are not legitimately to be purchased with TANF benefits, do you actually get caught? And is there actually any enforcement of the rule? It sounds like Florida plans to enforce that rule and enforce it very, very stringently. Anyway, glad to get your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. I do want to mention the story we had planned to talk to Nigel Jaquas about, and that is down in Curry County on the South Oregon coast. Curry County Sheriff John Ward is facing increasing pressure to resign. Now, we've asked Sheriff Ward to come on the show and explain some of the allegations against him, that he has taken things that did not belong to him, that belonged instead to the sheriff's department, and made them his own personal property. The takeaway from Willamette Week from an extraordinary 2000 Oregon Department of Justice criminal investigation that the Oregon Journalism Project obtained through a public records request. The Oregon State Police made allegations that a Curry County deputy sheriff, that's John Ward, had taken a deceased person's property during a suicide investigation. The report of the investigation said the troopers suspected that Ward had stolen sunglasses, and the belief was shared with a lieutenant in the sheriff's office. Deputy Ward declined to submit to a polygraph investigation. The investigation has not developed sufficient evidence to prove conclusively that there was a theft. But then the question is, what has Sheriff Ward been doing recently? You've heard Court Boyce, who's a state representative, come on this show, Representative Court Boyce from Gold Beach, who's actually said, even though he knows Sheriff Ward, even though He considers him a friend or an acquaintance, that he's suggested that Sheriff Ward should step down from his seat because he's no longer qualified to hold that seat. Oh, and then consider this. Apparently, Seattle has given up on rebuilding its police department. We're told Fox 13 of Seattle is reporting that effective today, the Seattle Police Department is no longer offering hiring incentives. Now, they're still going to be hiring police officers, but apparently they've dropped the incentives. They said this comes when the department was just starting to rebuild after its infamous defund the cops movement led to the mass exodus of officers who did not want to work for a city that actually hated them. So Fox 13's Alejandra Guzman interviewed the head of the Seattle Police Officers Guild, who said removing these incentives is going backward. This is not going to improve public safety, and I'd have to agree with that as well. Let's go to Dan. Hey, Dan, thanks for the call on the Radio Northwest Network. What's on your mind?
Well, it's about that woman that killed those, right?
Yeah. Yeah, Lindsey Clancy.
Okay.
And the jury is deadlocked, by the way, and they're being told by the judge, keep working at it. But so far, they've been telling the judge they can't reach a decision. So.
Oh, but here's a good question.
What
does the husband think should happen to her?
I don't know whether he's the husband. Patrick Clancy? I don't know that he's given an interview and talked about it, but can you imagine? What would you say about a member of your family that murders three of your young children? I would think you'd condemn that person, wouldn't you? I don't know that he's been quoted.
Certainly.
What's that?
Well, certainly. I agree with that.
Okay, but what's the point you're trying to make?
Well,
we've
got all these people that it's not their kids that got killed. What about the people that were directly affected by it? They should have the say.
Well, except that I don't, I've heard this before, I think. But if I'm understanding you correctly, Dan, you're saying we should ask the people most affected by it. You know who's affected by it? The reason every single trial that happens in a given state. So if a trial happens in Washington State, when they bring the charges, it's state of Washington versus Larson or Johnson or whoever. Because when you violate the laws of a state, you haven't just offended one person. You haven't just offended, say, the father. You've actually gone out and you've committed a crime against everyone in that state. So whether the family wants her prosecuted or not, I don't think is that relevant. What does matter is what have the people of that state said that you should do with a mother who murders her three children. And I think they've said you should convict her of a crime and send her to prison. Dan, thanks for the call. Mark, what's on your mind today? Sounds like Mark's Obama phone may have given up on him, but Mark, we appreciate the call. But in any case, you got to wonder what's going on in Seattle when they have a police department which is severely undersized for the size of the city of Seattle, with about 800,000 population inside the city and a metro area of about 2 million, they already are underfunded when it comes to cops, and now they've taken away the hiring incentives to try to get more cops on the job. If that makes sense to anybody, I'd be glad to hear the explanation. So, Seattle just killed its police hiring bonuses, while neighboring Bellevue is offering $30,000 to try to get officers to go to Bellevue instead. Is City Hall trying to rebuild its police force, or are they actually waving the white flag of surrender in the face of all those criminals? You're listening to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network.
The Lars Larson Show.
Are you thinking?
FM News 101.
In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
Live.
This is
the Lars Larson Show.
President Trump is one fat-ass president. He secured the border at a level we've never seen before.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
For our country and for our children, the best is yet to come.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network.
Lars.
And now.
He is an existential threat to democracy.
Here's your host.
Quiet, please.
Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a Wednesday. It's the Radio Northwest Network, and it's my pleasure to be with you. And you're invited to the conversation, although I want to talk to John Lee first. John, of course, is a state representative who represents people in District 18, position number 2. And the issue I want to put in front of John, because John actually brought it to me. And he said, look at this. The Interstate Bridge Project, this is, I guess, 2.0 of the attempts to build a bridge across the Columbia River to carry Interstate 5, the big connector that goes all the way from Canada to Mexico. And its biggest choke point is right there on the Columbia River between Oregon and Washington. And already they have spent a colossal one-third of $1 billion, and they don't have much to show for it except a big pile of paper. John, or Representative Lee, welcome back to the program. Tell my audience about this.
Hey, Lars, thanks so much. Monday, the IBR updated their spending as of the end of June, and they'd spent $321 million so far. And, of course, as you and I have talked about many times, that's on top of the $200 million they wasted on the failed CRC. So in reality, that's over $500 million of the people's money. And the project is only 30% designed after 6.5 years. What a huge waste of people's money, number one. Number two, in the 6.5 years since this got started, the cost has tripled to over $15 billion. And it would, so many facets of this are horrible. The alleged locally preferred alternative is preferred by nobody. It doesn't fix traffic congestion. It's a bridge too low. It allocates 54% of the space to transit, bikes, and pedestrian. And it's only less than a third designed. It's a huge waste of the people's money.
I guess part of what I don't understand about this, Representative Lee, is that Donald Trump has a transportation secretary. We've tried to get him on this show because I wanted to ask him, are you still going to provide federal funding for a project that is this seriously flawed? I mean, flawed in its design, flawed in its approval, as you said. It's too expensive. It's too low. It has light rail on it that nobody wants. It's got all these flaws to it, and it doesn't change traffic congestion at all. And ask, why is the Trump administration still backing this? And as of today, we can't get the transportation secretary or a surrogate to come anywhere near us to answer that question.
Yeah, I'd love to have a meeting, have them chat, just be honest with the people. Please, I think if they looked at the details of this, they would say, whoa, just like they pulled federal funding from the California high-speed rail boondoggle,
yep.
They need to look at this, and if they understand this boondoggle, they'd pull federal funding. I mean, look, they already pulled several hundred million dollars from the I-5 Rose Quarter project that has now exploded to over $3 billion, and there is a huge hole on that, $3 billion potentially, shortfall there. And so this is the largest public works project in the history of the two states, and it's out of control, and we definitely need some responsible oversight of this, which the two DOT secretaries, frankly, in Washington and Oregon, are not providing that necessary oversight. And that's where I want to, as a legislator, throw the BS flag.
Well, and the other thing I'm worried about, John, because the state of Oregon and the state of Washington both have a similar pattern. They will promise to build a project. They get well into the project. Then they announce it's going to cost a lot more. So either give us the money. We can't go backwards on this, and they will underbid something. They will understate what the cost of something is, and then once they're too far into it to turn around and go back the other direction, they'll then just tell the taxpayers and the lawmakers, you've got to fund this thing, and you've got to give us more money because you can't leave it half done. That is the pattern they have shown in all these projects, and I'm afraid on this one, they're going to get us into this project far enough and then say, by the way, there are tens of billions of dollars still needed to fund this thing, and you don't have the choice not to pay for it.
Yeah. And in reality, they've got around $5 billion, which is a stretch, on this $15 billion project. Nobody would start building a house if you only had a third of the money.
Nope.
And so what they're proposing now is to put it in two phases. And phase one, they still admit they're over $2 billion short of the money needed to build phase one. That is absolutely outrageous. In reality, we've got about $4 billion, $2.1 billion from the feds, a billion each from Washington and Oregon. And so what the legislators need to do on both sides of the river is go down the list of the components of this, and the IBR has a list of 30 components that yep. they admit only four of them are funded. And the legislators just need to slash and burn, say no, no, no. And in the end, they could build a bare-bones bridge with no extras for that $4 billion and say, no more. We've got so many needs on both the Washington side and the Oregon side for those transportation dollars, and they just need to say, enough, no more. A different facet of all of this, my friend, is that WSP, who is their primary consultant on this whole boondoggle,
yep.
they signed an original contract 6 years ago that said they would deliver the federal record of decision for $44 million. They've now spent $321 million delivering that. That's a sevenfold increase, and the two states' DOT secretaries simply rubber-stamped that sevenfold increase in taxpayer money. It just shows there's no oversight by this.
See, John, I want people to understand this. I mean, imagine if you had gone to any contractor and you said, I need this done for my house. I need a new kitchen, or I need a new bathroom, or whatever it is. And they gave you a number, like that $44 million number. And then, you know, the contractor came in and is doing the job, and right in the middle of it, he says, no, this is going to cost seven times as much money as I promised. And you say, no, you promised in writing that you will deliver it for this price. But the people who represent the people of Oregon and Washington, the representatives within the government, both elected reps like you, but also people who work within the bureaucracy, have chosen not to hold the contractor to the letter of what they signed their name to?
Yeah, it's ridiculous, and in essence, we're rewarding them for either incompetence or lying to us as legislators, and more importantly, misleading the people of both states, and that shouldn't be tolerated. And frankly, the federal government needs to come in and say, we're not going to spend a dime of our money if you're misleading the people and if you're allowing this theft of the people's money. You're rewarding a consultant that clearly can't consult in any level of accuracy. And a different aspect of this is I'm not forgetting that the IBR staff and their leadership chose to hide the actual cost increases from legislators and the people a year ago. We
yep.
had two meetings that they promised to give us the new cost estimates, and they withheld that information both times.
And they kept everybody in the dark. That's Representative John Lee. He represents District 18, Position 2. Back in a moment. Liberal elites are moving into rural America. Are they going to contaminate those communities too? On efficiency and...
taxes. What say you, Robin Hood?
So you think you're overtaxed?
Overtaxed, overworked, and paid off with a knife, a club, or a rope?
Why, you speak treason.
Fluently.
This is the Lars Larson Show.
Hey, welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. I'm glad to get to your phone calls and emails at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. Let me go first to Mark. Hey, Mark, welcome to the program. What's on your mind, sir?
Oh, I just, when you had the thing yesterday about the TANF and the SNAP, I have firsthand knowledge of at least the TANF. I've never been on the SNAP, but I'm also on the WIC program with my youngest, who's going to be four soon. And I always thought that because the supermarkets keep the sales history of your purchases, that the smarter you buy, the better. But I also and with the TANF. So when
TANF is the cash benefit. We used to call it welfare. There was a time when it was called the dole, but it's now called TANF, Temporary to Needy Families. I guess, should there be a limit on what you spend that cash on? If you're telling the government, you're telling your fellow taxpayers, I don't have enough money to get by on. And they say, okay, well, we'll give you some money to tide you over. And then you go out and blow the money on theme park tickets or tattoos or things like that. Aren't you effectively telling all those taxpayers, I got plenty of money because I got money to blow on tats and theme park tickets?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. My point is that for any kind of a custody type battle, and I've been at several juvenile hearings and in superior court during custody battles.
Yeah.
And I always thought as a lawyer, I would subpoena the sales history of that particular person.
No, but what would that tell you? I mean, if you're in a custody battle and assuming you could subpoena the record of what your wife's purchases at the grocery store or your purchases, what would that necessarily tell you that would help you in a custody battle for your kids?
I was under the assumption that you would be able to see what your, say, like my wife would be purchasing at the grocery store or at the
nail salon. Yeah, but it doesn't tell you what she's doing. Your wife could go to the grocery store and buy steak and eggs and all kinds of other stuff and then feed the kids top ramen. I mean, what she buys at the grocery store does not necessarily speak well, one way or the other, to how she's taking care of the kids. Is that what you're suggesting? You could go to the judge and say, look, Your Honor, my wife was spending her welfare money on either good food or bad food, and therefore you should award custody of the children to me based on how my wife was shopping at the grocery store?
Not necessarily custody, it would only be an argument.
An argument about custody, about who gets custody of the kids, right? How would it help you to say to the judge, my wife spends a lot of money on stupid stuff at the grocery store? How would that necessarily get you custody of the kids?
Well, that's good. That's a good point.
Well, I'm just saying, Mark, because it doesn't sound like it would actually help you in a custody situation, but I appreciate the call. Glad to get your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com, and it pains me to admit it, but I'm going to have to disagree with President Trump about one of the positions he's taken recently. Capitol Hill is being asked for a bailout by Hollywood. Hollywood, California, which used to be a center for a lot of movie production and television production, they have seen a gigantic drop-off in what they're doing on both movies and TV products. The number of, they count this in shoot days in Los Angeles. It's dropped from about 37,000 shoot days for TV and movies in 2022. And here we are 4 years later, they've dropped to below 20,000 shoot days. That's a gigantic drop, not quite by a drop of 46%. So the question is, should they get some kind of special federal tax credit, an incentive of 15 to 25% to encourage production of film and TV projects in Los Angeles? Donald Trump has apparently said he likes the idea. I do not. Should Capitol Hill bail out a failing Hollywood entertainment industry with your tax dollars? My answer to that would be absolutely positively no. It should not. The tax dollars should not do that. California is perfectly capable of bailing itself out. All they have to do is lower their fees and regulations and taxes and have some sensible policies. And Hollywood can do its part by actually producing things that the American moviegoers want to actually see. Now, I mentioned that liberal elites have been moving into rural America. And the question is, they're not looking for a quieter life, nor are they looking for the kind of conservative values that you and I might hold. I saw this brilliant piece of writing by a young lady by the name of Stella Morabito, who's been on the program. She points out Democrat elites despise rural voters. She points out that Karl Marx and Frederick Engels paved their way for their contempt by writing the Communist Manifesto, that the migration from small communities to large urban centers has rescued a considerable part of the population from the idiocy. This is what they wrote, idiocy of rural life. 200 years later, it seems there is a migration in reverse, with elites invading the hinterlands to rescue people in the rural areas from their continued idiocy. And then Morabito points something out. I actually talked about this story a week ago. One case in point is an episode at Wydeho Roasters, which is a coffee shop in a very, very red part of a very red state called Idaho. It is owned by a pro-abortion couple from Deep Blue, St. Paul, Minnesota, who moved off to a very conservative state and a very conservative town, Jim and Mary Sheehan. Sheehan has said that his coffee house welcomes everyone, but apparently that has some qualifications. In mid-August, so just a couple of weeks ago, a pro-life group met there to quietly talk about how to defeat Idaho's Proposition Number 1, a referendum that would allow abortions up to 24 weeks in gestation. Now, that's a perfectly acceptable thing to talk about. That's when babies are over a foot long and they can survive outside of mom. Well, Sheehan kicked them out of his coffee shop. So in other words, this is one of those liberals who believes that all are welcome here in our community. Oh, unless, of course, you're not completely in favor of killing unborn babies, in which case we're going to give you the boot. And what Morabito writes about is the fact that a lot of communities in the rural parts of America are being invaded by liberal elites who want to change and capture those rural parts of America so there will be no place for American conservatives to live, not the big cities and certainly not the rural areas either. Glad to be with you. Always glad to take your calls. 866-439-5277. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network.
The Lars Larson Show. Portland's news, traffic, and dropping a Portland truth bomb.
My favorite thing about living in Portland is no matter how many fentanyl overdoses happen, no matter how many tents get set up, you can't blame black people for that.
Back to Lars.
Hey, welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. I'm glad to get to your phone calls and emails. First, I want to talk to Ryan Young, who's a senior economist and director of publications at the Competitive Enterprise Institute. Hey, Ryan, welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me.
So Senator Chuck Schumer wants to kill Donald Trump's tariffs, and he wants to hand the money back to Americans. I know he'd like to behave like Santa Claus heading up to an election, but he's getting some support from free market conservatives. Why is that?
Oh, the tariffs are hurting Americans' affordability, and we'll take allies wherever we can get them. I don't expect this friendship to last much longer than, say, the next 2 years, but I'll take it. You know, the Republicans have some of their own bills, and I'll take a Democratic one as well.
So what do you think is the future of these tariffs anyway, given the court decisions that have happened? Where do we stand with all this?
Well, the two that this Chuck Schumer bill would treat are both undergoing legal challenges in court, and I would wager that they'll get overturned, but that is a year or more off, whereas Congress, now that they're back in session, if they really want to, they could overturn those tariffs today.
But they're probably going to choose not to because Donald Trump still supports them, right?
That is correct. A GOP majority is not going to go against the president on this one. We have a few members, not just Rand Paul, but also a few others, mostly who have lost primaries and can say what they want now, who have come out against the tariffs on affordability grounds and on America's national interest grounds. But I don't think there are enough numbers to get either a Schumer bill or a similar Republican bill passed.
Okay, so Ryan, have you figured out what it is that Donald Trump's, I mean, he's not a stupid guy, and he's got some pretty good political instincts at times. And yet on this one just seems like a dumb move all the way along. Does that mean that it is a dumb move, or does it mean that it's a move that we don't understand what the president's real agenda is and that that's why he's sticking with it?
I think it's inspired in part by Roy Cohn, who said, never admit a mistake. And the trade war, especially with Canada, of all countries, is a mistake, but the president's not going to go back on that. In fact, he's doubling down on it, and it's not helping his own party. It's creating an opening for Chuck Schumer because the country's two-thirds against tariffs. The politically smart thing to do right now is to turn against you've supported them in the past. So that's why we're seeing what we're seeing. The president made a mistake, and hopefully he'll change his mind, but he's not going to admit that he made a mistake on this one.
Well, but he's also found some very good ways to, you know, to change things without having to admit you made a mistake. But is that what's going on with Canada? Do you think that the government of the Carney's government out of Canada is really just acting based on practical grounds on tariffs, or are they trying to use the trade situation between the United States and Canada as a way to influence the outcome of our midterm elections? Because I've seen that theory advanced as well. Is there any currency to that, do you think?
Maybe, but I don't think it would have any effect in the U.S. On Trump's end, I think it's just personal. He didn't like Justin Trudeau. He doesn't like Mark Carney. It's just personal. Tariffs have always been a gut thing with him. And on Mark Carney's end, he's kind of trapped because Canadians, nicest people on earth, they are up in arms against America right now. They're surprised, shocked. They feel betrayed. You know, what's our big brother doing to us? This is out of nowhere. So if the smart thing to do in a trade war is not to play. The only way to win is not to play. Matthew Broderick said it best, but Carney's political constituency is up in arms. If he was to do the right thing and not retaliate, he would lose his job. He kind of has to retaliate politically, and that's just not good for Canada. It's not good for America. It's not good for anybody.
I'm talking to Ryan Young, who's a senior economist at the Competitive Enterprise Institute. So here's the part I really don't understand. Donald Trump, you know, gives amazingly long stories, speeches. He'll show up in front of a press conference and answer questions for a long time. He seems almost willing to over-explain things. Why is he not, if he thinks he's got a real agenda here and that does work and works for Americans, why do you suppose the president isn't taking the time to actually try to explain it and get Americans to back him on this move?
It's pretty hard, and he's constrained in part by the law. If you remember those steel, aluminum, and copper tariffs, he has to cite a national security justification, because that's what that little bit of legislation says that he has to do. So in a phone call with Justin Trudeau, I mean, it's Canada. They're not a national security threat. He actually cited the War of 1812 in a phone call. With these newest tariffs, it's forced labor. Now, that's a valid concern with China. It's a valid concern with certain Middle Eastern and African countries. It is not a valid concern with Canada, but that's what the law says he has to cite, so he's citing it, and that's probably why it's going to get overturned in court. So he's trying all these different rationales, and one by one they're getting shot down, but the process is slow enough where if he really wants to, he can probably write it out for the rest of his term.
Yeah, it probably can. What effect do you think it's going to have on the midterm elections, though? Because an awful lot of Americans are very frustrated at the cost of everything right now.
Well, people in Michigan are just getting killed economically. Nationwide, tariffs are equivalent to about a $1,000 per household tax increase. In Michigan, especially in the auto industry, it's so tightly intertwined with Canada, we're talking about a $5,000 economic effect per household. So this is something that's hitting regular people, and it's hitting them hard. It's hitting a couple of other swing states that have close trading relationships with Canada, Pennsylvania as well, New York State. And that's not going to benefit Republicans because the president owns the tariff issue, and he is proud to own the tariff issue.
And Ryan, that means you don't expect to see Donald Trump try to find an off-ramp from this policy sometime in the next 60 days.
No, I think the courts and Congress are going to have to do that for him. But one way, with the way cost of living is going and with the large role tariffs are playing in that cost of living difficulties, something has to be done. It might not happen until after the midterms. It might be something from the Republicans. It might be something from the Democrats. But something has to give.
Yeah. And then we got the strange bedfellows of having Chuck Schumer in there as well. Hey, Ryan, thanks very much. I appreciate what you do at the Competitive Enterprise Institute, and we always are appreciative of your insights.
Thank you, Lars.
Thanks, sir. That is Ryan Young from the Competitive Enterprise Institute. He's the senior economist and director of publications. Glad to be with you on a Wednesday. Always glad to take your calls. If you want to vote in our X poll, the question is, should Capitol Hill bail out a failing Hollywood entertainment industry with your tax dollars? My answer to that is no. You can answer the X poll question any way you like. You'll find it at Lars Larson Show on X. You'll also find it on our website at LarsLarson.com. And yesterday, should welfare recipients be allowed to spend taxpayer-funded benefits on anything they want, like theme park tickets and tattoos and the like? My answer to that, of course, was no. 96% of you agreed with me. Only 4% of you said yes in answer to that question. Back in a moment. Glad to take your calls. 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. Losing it now, and you want.
Have something to say? Give Lars a call at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-HEY-LARS. Now, back to the Lars Larson Show.
Hey, welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. An Oregon State employee has now collected about $500,000 while sitting at home for the last 3 years. So why won't the state either put him back to work or resolve the case, either fire him or put him back on the job? I'll get to that story in just a moment. First, welcome to the Lars Larson Show. Glad to have you with me and always glad to take your phone calls and your emails at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. And this segment of the show is brought to you by eLegacy. You've spent your whole life building up your estate. Don't leave it to chance. Make sure you set up your kids or grandkids well. Go to elegacylars.com and call for a complimentary consultation. That's elegacylars.com. And by the way, eLegacy, Tina and I decided to have that kind of custom estate plan put together. I mean, we're not rich, but the fact is we wanted to make sure that my granddaughter and daughter are taken care of. And so we put that plan together. And we did that a long time before I began doing ads on the air for eLegacy. And I very much believe in the company. So elegacylars.com. Now, my favorite email of the day so far today comes in from a guy by the name of Dave Lister that I've known for more than 30 years. And I don't often put acquaintances' emails on the program, but my email of the day is brought to you by Multnomah Medical Clinic. No pills, no shots, no surgery. Fix what's actually causing the problem at Multnomah Medical Clinic. Dave wrote in. Dave's in the computer software business, has been for a long, long time. And he said, Lawrence, back in the early 2000s, I wrote a fanciful piece for Brainstorm Northwest magazine entitled Portland 2026. You might remember it. Part of it predicted you being on the air 20 hours a day, including broadcasting to colonists on Mars. I wrote it as a satire predicting what Portland would look like after 50 years of so-called smart growth. Bums were carrying card swipe devices, crows were on the endangered species list, and I couldn't use my car because of the traffic calming devices that resembled the tank traps on the Siegfried line. I would have never believed that it would all eventually come true. And even worse than my satire and vision, here we are in Portland 2026, signed your friend Dave Lister. Now, and then let me tell you about this state hospital employee who's been on paid leave now for 3 years. Now, he said he'd like to go back to work. Consider the way this is being reported. Derek Weir, who is Oregon State Hospital's former deputy superintendent, he has now been on paid leave for 3 years. That has cost the taxpayers about $500,000, according to Eugene Springfield Lookout. Mr. Weir wants to go back to work. The state hospital has said we do not want him back. Spurring it all years ago were complaints that Weir made about practices at the state hospital, which then led to counter investigations into Weir himself. So 3 years later, it's unclear where things stand, and that reflects the speed of state government bureaucracy. Well, justice delayed is justice denied. The issue needs to be resolved. The ever slow state of Oregon paid a total of 288 employees about $3.2 million to be on paid leave this last year and stay home. That's according to KGW. Consider that. In a private company, would the boss let you put somebody on paid leave for 3 years and not either decide fire the person or put him back on the job, but we're not paying him to do nothing? Well, state government is very, very different. Let's go to Jim. Hey, Jim, welcome to the Radio Northwest Network. What's on your mind?
Oh,
the $40 trillion national debt a couple of weeks ago, I guess we officially hit it, and I found some global frustration. One, we're at $40 trillion. But number two, 31 years ago, there was an attempt to put a constitutional balanced budget amendment out to the states, and the final vote came down to Mark Hatfield, and he said no. And right now, that looks like a, oh, God bless Mark, but that was a $40 trillion mistake, it looks like.
I don't know that that would have changed anything. Do you understand what I mean?
No.
Well, the thing is, you know that every single state, well, I think there might be one state that's accepted from this, but every state in America is required to run a balanced budget. You're aware of that, right?
Right.
Okay, so the state of Oregon, for example, has what they claim is a balanced budget. Does that mean the state of Oregon has not run up tens of billions of dollars in debts that it does not have the money to pay? It does. It has gigantic debts. And if you say, but they have a constitution that requires a balanced budget. Yes, they do. And then what they do is they borrow money beyond what they've got. So, for example, the state of Oregon has a public employee retirement system that makes promises to employees saying, if you work for us, when you get to retirement, we will pay you a pension of such and such a size. It's a defined, what's called a defined benefit pension rather than a defined contribution, which would be like a 401k. So, for example, on the PERS system alone, the state of Oregon is underwater, upside down, anywhere from $26 to $50 billion. And if you say, but hold on, they have a balanced budget. Yeah, every year. They say we have this much money coming in, and we're spending that much money. But we've also borrowed a lot of money. ODOT, for example, the state's transportation agency, got its first borrowing authority, I believe it was in the 1990s, and within about a decade or so, they had filled the entire credit card, and they couldn't borrow anymore. And so, you know, the fact that you have a balanced budget requirement in your constitution doesn't necessarily mean you can't go out and borrow money and run up debts. And that's what you've done. And the biggest part of America's debt is not that $40 trillion. Did you know that?
I thought I heard that. I didn't fully understand it.
Well, let me tell you why. Do you get Social Security?
Yeah.
Okay. Do you know the government is short of the money to pay Social Security by tens of trillions of dollars?
I didn't know that.
Okay, well, they are. I mean, the United States of America knows that it's going to start actually running out of the money to pay full Social Security by about 2034, about six or 7 years from now. They will run short, and they'll be forced to either cut it or raise taxes. So are the tens of trillions of dollars they owe to all those Social Security recipients, is that included in the $40 trillion in official national debt? It's not.
It's
off the books. And that means that at the end of the day, there are hundreds of trillions of dollars that America is obligated to pay, and that the country has absolutely no idea where that money's going to come from. Thanks for a good call, Jim.
The Lars Larson Show.
FM News 101.
In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
Lars. This is the Lars Larson Show.
President Trump is one badass president. He secured the border at a level we've never seen before.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
For our country and for our children, the best is yet to come.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network.
Lars.
And now.
He is an existential threat to democracy.
Here's your host.
Quiet, please.
Lars Larson.
Hey, welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. So a Washington state law that is meant to keep families together may actually be putting babies in great danger. Is that policy to protect the kids, or is it potentially costing them their lives? We're going to talk about that. But first, welcome to the Lars Larson Show. If you want to join the best conversation in talk journalism, it happens right here every day at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. Naysayers always go to the head of the line on this program for 30 years and always will. And you can answer our X poll question. You'll find it at Lars Larson Show on X. You'll also find it on my website at LarsLarson.com. And it's great to welcome Carlene Johnson back, staff reporter at the Center Square. And she's been covering a story involving the death of a little boy and the mother who's in court and the system that may have let that child down. Carlene, welcome back.
Hi, Lars. Yeah, too many times we talk about these stories. You've got a baby boy, a one-year-old little boy, under state supervision, 39-year-old mom. They knew she had a fentanyl addiction. Dad apparently is a coke addict, and the state has been involved. In fact, the state saw the family as recently as August 5th. Caseworker did a cheek swab. Mom tested positive for drugs, but they left the baby and the two-and-a-half-year-old sibling in the apartment, in one of those seedy low-barrier, no-barrier apartments that are subsidized by taxpayers in Seattle. And then, you know, then he gets brought out in a body bag. I mean, it's just, it breaks my heart. And I don't know why people aren't more outraged than they are, really.
Okay, so tell me this. Is this the law working the way they wrote the law to work? I mean, as bizarre as that sounds to say, the result was a dead child and a child left in the hands of somebody who tested positive for illegal drugs, but the child was left there anyway. But that was what the law was designed to do, wasn't it?
Right. The Keeping Families Together Act, which was actually passed by many Republicans at the time, supported it because this was kind of in response to too many kids being yanked out of homes. You've got, you know, somebody that complains about a parent, maybe the house looks in disarray, and they yank the kid out, and the kid ends up in, you know, foster care and maybe traumatizes the child, and it maybe shouldn't have happened. So this was kind of a response to that. But we went so far the other way, and it was at the very same time we had this massive drug epidemic, you know, the increase of, you know, and fentanyl came onto the scene, and it just made everything exponentially worse because now we're leaving kids and we're doing it in the name of racial justice, especially we want to keep black and brown kids with their black and brown family members. And so we're going to leave them in there even if the parent is a drug addict, even if there's a presence of drugs in the home and you see that the kid's being neglected. That's what we're doing, and we're losing more kids than ever.
You know, see, what I don't understand about this, Carlene, is if I compare this, say, to drunk driving or driving under the influence, you get pulled over and you're positive for marijuana. You fail the, you know, the test, the side of the road, touch your nose, walk a line test. They take you out of the car and they say, you can't drive away, you know, and you say, you, because in your state, you cannot be trusted to drive this car down the road. And yet you'll leave a child, a very young child, in the hands of somebody like that, say, well, you're positive for a really serious illegal drug, but we can still trust you to take care of your one-year-old child. That's what we're saying. I mean, and I don't even know, did Republicans not anticipate that this thing taken to its logical extreme, which is what they've done, is going to have the result of dead babies?
Well, they figured it out by the next year and went back and have been trying the last three legislative sessions to get majority Democrats to fix this imminent harm standard. Because, Lars, your listeners may or may not be surprised to know that a caseworker can come into a home for a family that's on their radar. Okay, we know we've got drug-addicted parents. They can come in. They can see used drug, you know, foil out, whatever, fentanyl, whatever, on the coffee table, and you've got the baby in the bassinet next to it, or maybe it's a toddler walking around. And instead of being able, even though the social worker may want to take that kid from the home, the social worker cannot, under the imminent harm standards, say, this child is at risk of imminent harm. Seems like so illogical, but it's impossible to get that kid removed from the home. So they leave him and they say, okay, mama, here's a lockbox for your drugs. After you get high, make sure you lock up everything, tuck your kids safely into bed, and then, you know, everything's going to be good.
Isn't that the very problem, though? Is that when you're high, I mean, whether you're high on fentanyl or high on alcohol or high on almost anything, your judgment goes to hell. So you're expected to lock your drugs up after you're high and before your kids get to it, especially given fentanyl. Your child only needs to get a little bit of that stuff on his or her skin or in his or her mouth, and the kid can end up dead as well.
And that's what happened to this precious baby. And the guy I interviewed who works with Andrea Suarez at We Heart Seattle, Tim, who's a recovered addict himself, he was heartbroken. He watched that baby be brought out in a tiny little body bag from that dump of an apartment, which I've been inside of. It's infested with, you know, drug addicts, cockroaches, rats. No human should be in there, let alone babies. And he watched him pulled out in a body bag, and he was tearful. And he said, why are we doing this? We're killing these babies. And the Democrats in Olympia, year after year, have been saying, well, we think we're making slight adjustments in the law, and give it some time to play out. I would argue there's no time.
I want people to be held responsible. And I know people may think that I take that to the nth degree, and I do. And in fact, I'm not going to back down from it. If you've got a child and you aren't capable of taking care of the child because you're intoxicated or because you're on illegal drugs, we're going to take the child away. You want the child back? Get off the drugs. It's that simple. And if we don't do it that way, then we're basically just saying, oh, this child is the property of this addict. And we can't deprive this addict of the property that they own, this child that they own, even if it would be better for the child. Well, we may take away a dog from this addict because the dog's in danger, but we're not going to take the child away. That's the insanity that Democrats have brought, and they're the ones responsible for this, aren't they?
They are 100%, and I know there are a couple of Republican lawmakers who are hugely passionate about this, one of them being Representative Travis Couture. He is planning not only legislation again for this next session to try and again convince Democrats to please, for the love of God, save these kids. He intends to get the federal government involved because these children are being deprived of their rights to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness by languishing in these homes with drug-addicted parents. They have no rights at this point. I mean, so who's standing up for them? So they're trying to get the feds involved. I really hope that ends up happening. I don't know what else is going to, if the Democrats won't fix it here in Washington, we got to get the feds involved.
You've got to read this story by Carlene Johnson at the Center Square. Carlene, it's always a pleasure. Back in just a moment. Glad to get to your phone calls and emails. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network. And a glossy brochure.
Disagree with Lars? Great. Naysayers go first at 866-HEY-LARS. Now, back to the Lars Larson Show.
Hey, welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you and a real pleasure to welcome back to the program Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter Nigel Jaquez, who writes for both Willamette Week, that's WWeek.com, and also writes for the Oregon Journalism Project. Nigel, good to have you back on.
Thanks, Lars, and let me apologize to you and your listeners. I was supposed to be with you around 12:30, and I completely failed. Yeah, my apologies.
No problem. We'll move on from that because I want to know what we should make of a sheriff in the Northwest down in Curry County on the South Oregon coast by the name of John Ward, because it sounds like he's been caught dead to rights, if the reporting is to be believed, taking a very expensive equipment and buildings and everything else that actually belonged to the public and converting it to his own use. And it's not the first time that this has happened, because your reporting takes his history all the way back to the year 2000, right?
Yes, I had reported earlier on a variety of issues on which the sheriff has apparently violated Oregon ethics laws and perhaps Oregon criminal laws relating to his converting public assets to personal use. The news story that we published yesterday goes back to 2000, when he was accused by the Oregon State Police of stealing sunglasses from a scene of a suicide, a pair of Oakley sunglasses. Ward and a state trooper responded to the suicide scene. A month later, state trooper noticed that Ward was wearing what he thought were the very same pair of sunglasses that were at the scene. The issue was referred to the DA's office. The DA said, look, the lie detector tests and pass. We'll end this investigation now. Ward refused. He refused continually to turn the sunglasses over. It came to the point, Lars, where an investigator for the Oregon Department of Justice went to Ward's home with a search warrant to get the sunglasses. So it was resistant the whole time. The investigation stretched on for 11 months. There were 65 people interviewed. I thought it was very interesting that more than half of those people interviewed were law enforcement officers. So they were essentially confronted with the fact that the State Department of Justice believed that John Ward had stolen the sunglasses and was lying about it. So for the last 26 years, you've had a large number of law enforcement officials in Southern Oregon who have been aware of the fact that this guy was, you know, a suspect in a serious crime, and I just find that remarkable, frankly.
Not only a serious crime, but just a disgusting crime. I mean, if it's true that he stole the sunglasses from a dead man, from a man who had committed suicide, I mean, it isn't so much the amount or the dollar amount. It's more, what do you call it, the ick factor, how dare you steal things from a dead man, and you're part of law enforcement. So he's got this trust issue. And then more recently, he's been accused of taking everything from, what, a building to jet skis to boats to other equipment and converting it to his own use. And yet he's maintaining that he's not going to quit his job.
Yeah, I mean, I reported last week that the Oregon Sheriff's Association, which is exactly what it sounds like, each of the 36 sheriffs belongs to it, they voted unanimously to expel Sheriff Ward from their organization. They've only ever done that one time in their history prior to this. So, his fellow law enforcement officers have clearly lost confidence in him. His county board of commissioners has unanimously called upon him to resign. His local state representative, Court Boyce, has called upon him to resign. At this point, you have a guy who is just trying desperately to hang on to his position, and has obviously forgotten that he's there to serve the public and is only serving himself.
I guess what my first conclusion on this is, because I look at it, I don't know this guy. I don't think I've ever met Sheriff Ward, but even if I have, I'm just curious if he honestly believes that he didn't take any of this equipment or, the material, the property and all that, then come out and explain, how did all this stuff come into your possession, and wasn't it actually the property of the Curry County Sheriff's Office, where you're the sheriff? And if you didn't convert it to your own use, then explain to us how you came to possess all this stuff and whether it's legitimate. I mean, if somebody asked me, hey, Lawrence, how'd you get your pickup truck? I'd say, I'll tell you where I bought it. I'll tell you when I bought it. I'll tell you how much I paid for it. I mean, if it was the matter of a criminal investigation, this seems like something that if he has a legitimate possession of these things, he'd be able to prove that fairly readily. And if he doesn't, then he should do a mea culpa and say, look, I took the stuff and I converted it to my use, and I'm going to give it back. But one or the other, pick one.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's very clear that the shed that you referred to cost about $53,000. It was built
shed
on his property with public money, and it's titled in his name. There's a 30-foot travel trailer that was bought with public money, and it is titled in his name. I mean, it's as clear as day.
And so how's this going to be resolved? Because it sounds like he'll be able to brazen this through for a period of time, but at some point I kind of expect he'll tender his resignation and go off happily with his PERS pension. And are we going to see that outrage as well?
Well, this will be resolved, I suspect, by the DPSST, the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training, which regulates police officers. The County Board of Commissioners has turned over an independent investigation and asked them to revoke his law enforcement certification. If the DPSST does that, which they will take up, I believe, in November, then at that point he can't really serve anymore. So I suspect that that is how it may be resolved. Of course, There are other ways it could be resolved in the meantime, including his resignation, but he seems unwilling to do that.
Yeah, and I got to tell you something, Nigel. One of the things that always gnaws at me, and it doesn't come up all the time, is this question of what happens when people in these positions end up being able to retire and get a big fat check from the public for the rest of their days. And you say, well, they still get their pension? Even if they were caught breaking the law in their law enforcement job that we're doing? And the short answer is, yeah, they still get the pension. They still get all that.
Lars,
yes, go ahead.
I have not written this, but he is already collecting his PERS pension, and he is collecting a full salary as well. So he is doing what you and I used to refer to as double dipping.
Double dipping. Wow. Well, I'll tell you what. State lawmakers could change that. They could say that your pension is forfeit if you have been found guilty of misdeeds in public office, you know, while doing, allegedly doing the public's work. You can read his reporting at WWeek.com. He also writes for the Oregon Journalism Project. He's Pulitzer Prize winning reporter Nigel Jaquez. Nigel, thanks very much. I appreciate your time. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network.
The Lars Larson Show. Portland's news, traffic, and weather station.
Lars reads every email. No, really. Talk at LarsLarson.com. That's talk at LarsLarson.com. Now, back to the Lars Larson Show.
Hey, welcome back to the program. It's a pleasure to be with you. Well, the Trump administration just killed an Obama-era rule that it blames for driving up housing costs nationwide. Was it red tape or protection for disabled renters? Now, that would put that question to Frank Cassidy. He's former federal housing commissioner and assistant secretary for housing at HUD under President Trump. Mr. Cassidy, welcome back to the program. How are you, sir?
Thank you for having me on.
So when people hear about this rule, go ahead, sir. I'm sorry to interrupt.
Big win here. Common sense win from the Trump administration for housing affordability. The Obama-era policy basically allowed apartment owners to be held responsible for accessibility issues dating back decades, even when they didn't build the property or create the accessibility issue. So owners were essentially being targeted for buildings that had accessibility issues. And we're talking things like, hey, your countertop is 22 inches and it should be 24 inches. And it's an owner who, and it's two or three owners removed from the owner that built the building 10 years ago. And by the way, when they built the building 10 years ago, it passed every type of inspection. So they essentially weaponized the Fair Housing Office and would send spotters into these buildings. I heard stories from dozen of developers when I was in the Trump administration where essentially they would send in spotters and say, hey, your countertop here is 22 inches. It needs to be 24 inches because of the Fair Housing Act. And they would essentially shake them down and threaten to go after every one of their apartment buildings. So it was just the strategy for all these owners was to just settle it, because basically the Obama administration interpreted the Fair Housing Act to say that the statute of limitations never applied. So essentially, you know, any apartment building in the country was a fair target for them. And under the new change here, Assistant Secretary for Fair Housing Craig Treanor reinterpreted this statute to essentially say that, hey, guys, you got 1, potentially 2 years to identify a fair housing violation, and not 5, 10, 15 years after the building was built with an owner that didn't even build it. Because what happened was this was resulting in hundreds of thousands of dollars of retrofits to these apartment buildings and hundreds of millions of dollars across the country being spent. And ultimately that cost gets passed on to the homeowner or to the renter. So this is a big win for housing affordability. It's cutting bureaucratic red tape, and it should help make particularly apartment rental projects much more affordable.
I'm talking to Frank Cassidy, who's former federal housing commissioner, assistant secretary for housing at HUD. So was this done deliberately, this no grandfathering of prior existing conditions in a building? Because I think everybody who's ever owned a house knows there are things about the house that don't meet current code, but that's okay because you're grandfathered in unless you decide to make major changes. And yet, do you think the Obama administration deliberately wrote that to be as problematic as it turned out to be?
Yeah, absolutely. So in 2013, under the Obama administration, they interpreted the Fair Housing Act to basically say if there's a violation, the violation lives forever and there's no statute of limitation. So a building that was built and passed muster at the time, 10 years later, with a new owner, they would send spotters in and say, oh, well, this is a violation. The statute of limitations doesn't apply and you need to settle this. Otherwise, it's going to cost you hundreds of thousands of dollars to retrofit your building. And by the way, your other apartment building down the street, we're going to go take a look at that one next. So it really was an incorrect interpretation of the Fair Housing Act. Courts have always said that the statute of limitation does apply, but it was really a complete weaponization of HUD's Office of Fair Housing. And this interpretation cuts through that incorrect interpretation, and it should help with housing affordability because ultimately that cost just got passed on to the tenants in the building. It was another bureaucratic tax.
And Mr. Cassidy, if I can, look, a long million years ago, I owned a little duplex, so I had to deal with code things and things like that. And I was happy to, you know, to come up to code. But here's the question I've got. If you go to an apartment and you say, well, this doesn't meet current code, the countertop, as you said, has to be 24 inches tall, not 22. And so you make all these changes, spend all this money, and it may be that the current tenants don't give a damn whether the counter is 22 or 24, but what they'd really like is some new carpet or maybe some paint on the walls, except the same money that would have funded those things is now going to these unnecessary repairs that should be covered by grandfathering. And so they get cheated two different ways, don't they?
And by the way, if a building owner's got to put a couple hundred thousand dollars into the project to meet these accessibility retrofits, what happens? That cost gets passed on to the renter in terms of a higher rent. And as you nailed it, that's money that could have been used for, you know, a new carpet or a new washer and dryer. So it was really a flawed interpretation of the Fair Housing Act. It resulted in hundreds of millions of dollars of wasted money, and it contributed to making housing, you know, unaffordable for a lot of Americans.
Well, Frank, is this one of those changes that's made, I guess, administratively or in the bureaucracy, so that means the next administration, if God forbid it happens to be a Democrat administration, they can just flip it back the other way? Or can we actually get some certainty for the folks who run housing?
Yeah, well, unfortunately, it is a reinterpretation, so there is the risk that another Democrat administration could reinterpret it back to how it was with Obama. So we really do need Congress to act on this and amend the Fair Housing Act.
Mr. Cassidy, having worked in the federal bureaucracy, how much confidence do you have that Congress will actually do its job? You know, I know it's heavy lifting to have to say, fix this law and pass one that actually makes sense, but that is their job, right?
Absolutely. It's tough sailing right now in D.C. It's tough to get Congress to do much of anything.
Yeah, isn't that sad? Mr. Cassidy, thank you very much. What are you up to these days?
So I'm back in the private sector, commercial mortgage banking, financing commercial real estate all across the country, particularly multifamily apartment financing and senior housing.
And wouldn't it be nice to have some lower rates?
And Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac.
Wouldn't it be nice to have some lower rates right now?
That's what we're hoping for.
I'll tell you what, one of the things I'd love to, let me put a bug in your ear, Mr. Cassidy. I would love to see Fannie and Freddie and the rest of those federal agencies. I'd love to say, hey, there are a bunch of states that have reasonable rules and regulations for building housing, not Los Angeles, you know, but there are other places that do. We're going to give the best rates to the places with the best, you know, requirements, the permitting and the fees that in L.A. can cost up to, you know, 30% of the cost of a house. And in the places that have the crazy rules, you're going to pay the punitive rates. I'd love to see that as a way to get the federal government to straighten out some of the old stuff that's going on at the local level. That's Frank Cassidy. He's former federal housing commissioner, assistant secretary for housing at HUD under President Trump, and now back in the private sector. You got the Lars Larson Show. need a simple solution that actually...
Missed the Lars Larson Show? Get the podcast right now at LarsLarson.com. Now, more with Lars Larson.
Hey, welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. I am very concerned about the subject of human trafficking. And in fact, we all know that the human trafficking got a gigantic boost for about 4 years while President Autopen Joe Biden was in office, because the Mexican drug cartels, who also trafficked in human beings, they never found a better friend than in Joe Biden. Joe Biden, who opened up the southern border wide, and now Donald Trump. Donald Trump has actually helped to shut human trafficking down by making our southern border very secure. But consider this. What would you say if a state said, we're going to have a human trafficking hotline? We're going to set up a special number that can be called from anywhere. And then they did that, and they put it into publications. They put it online. They put it everywhere you might want to find it, so that people who might be the subject of human trafficking could actually call that number and get some help. And then what would you think if you found out that for years, the number itself has been erased, the number itself has been disconnected? That means the human trafficking victim who actually says, I'm going to call that number, I'm going to get some help, I'm going to get out of being trafficked as a human being and sold, and then you call the number, and you don't get any answer at all. Let me tell you the rest of that story in just a moment. First, welcome to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm glad to get to your phone calls and emails. If you want to join the best conversation in talk journalism, it's here every day at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. If you're a naysayer, you go straight to the head of the line at 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com and vote in our X poll. We put up a brand new poll question every day from the news of the day. Should Capitol Hill bail out a failing Hollywood entertainment industry in California, and should they do it with your tax dollars? Hollywood has thumbed its nose at middle-class America for many decades, as pointed out by our friends Steve Moore and the Committee to Unleash Prosperity. But they say now they want average Americans to bail them out. Many of the once-rich Hollywood studios are now going bankrupt, or they're leaving Tinseltown. So now the Hollywood brass want a taxpayer bailout. Unfortunately, President Trump has embraced a proposal for a federal tax credit of 15% up to 25% to encourage production of films and TV projects. This is a bailout for Los Angeles. It's a bailout for Hollywood. Employment and production in Hollywood and in Los Angeles has dropped by about half. The number of on-location shoot days in L.A. has fallen from 37,000 days in 2022 to less than 20,000 days in 2025. That is a drop of 46%. Production has shifted where else? To places where labor is cheaper and the union rules are less stringent. Donald Trump says these tax credits are going to pay for themselves 10 times over. And again, Steve Moore at the Committee to Unleash Prosperity, he's a former Donald Trump advisor. And as to the president's claim that using these tax credits to reinvigorate Hollywood will pay for itself, even Steve Moore says, no, we seriously doubt that's going to happen. Glad to get your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. Let me tell you the rest of what's going on with the human trafficking hotline to nowhere. The state of Washington says, we're going to put up a telephone number, and people will be able to call this number. A new performance audit that comes, believe it or not, from a Democrat state auditor by the name of Pat McCarthy, found that the victim assistance phone number in the state of Washington, plastered on human trafficking materials, it was disconnected more than two years ago. And yet it stayed on in mandatory workplace posters, government websites. It's even mentioned in three different state laws. The department, this is from Shift Law, the Department of Commerce was legally required to review its model anti-trafficking notice annually. They had to do it every year. The state apparently reviewed it once in 2016, and then they never bothered to do it again. Commerce has also not provided updated trafficking materials, which means the same phone number is being used, and people are being told, call this number if you need help. And when people call the number, they get no answer at all. And what does that tell you? Well, it turns out that massage business is the most commonly reported venue for sex trafficking in almost any state in 2024. They are not required to display the trafficking awareness signs at all. Yeah, posters. That's all we're talking about. Putting a phone number up so that when people believe that they are in trouble, that they're the subject of human trafficking, they can actually call a number and get some help. State agencies have given themselves until August of next year to clean up this mess. And they say that state politicians never seem to run out of time for proclamations and task forces and press releases and all the rest of this garbage. And yet when it comes to helping out the victims of human trafficking, all of a sudden, a failed effort like this, there's no effort to go out and find the people who actually made the bad decisions. Somebody decided to disconnect that victim assistance phone number. Somebody may have said, hey, we're wasting money on this phone number. Why don't we get rid of it or change it to a different number? Find that person. If that person is still working in government, that person should lose his or her job. It doesn't make any sense that we have this kind of incompetence when it comes to government, especially when it comes to a subject as serious as human trafficking, selling human beings. And in fact, the very existence of a human trafficking business, aided and abetted by Mexican drug cartels and others at the southern border, the fact is we ought to be going out and helping the people who are very much at risk of that, and some of those people are kids as well. By the way, if you believe in supporting American craftsmanship, veterans, and independent talk radio, do this. Go to my website and pick up one of the challenge coins we have there, the limited edition Lars Larson Show challenge coin. It's made by American veterans. Everyone comes with a personally signed thank you card from me, and all proceeds benefit American veterans because we'd had a challenge coin for a long time. I decided to have one made for the show. We found a veterans group years ago. And then that veterans group went out of existence. And for a number of years, we didn't have a way to make those coins. And we wanted them made in America. And we wanted them made by a veterans group. Well, we finally found another veterans group to do that. And they get the benefit of all that. We don't collect a penny from it. It's just there for your enjoyment and to benefit American veterans. Send your emails to talk at LarsLarson.com. And if you want to join the best conversation in talk journalism, it's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk at LarsLarson.com.
The Lars Larson Show.
FM News 101.